Seth Shostak with us from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. This hour, we flip the switch and take your phone calls with him next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Seth Shostak with us this hour. Next hour, we're going to be talking about the incredible Chasing the Sun, how the science of sunlight shapes our bodies and our minds. Seth, how'd you get interested in astronomy and physics and all this?
Well, George, it goes way back to my childhood. But maybe that doesn't surprise anyone.
No, not at all. We all did that.
Yeah, I think everybody does that. I think somewhere between 8 and 11, some switches get set in your brain and you become interested in something. And I built a telescope by age 10 or 11, was trying to take photos of Jupiter's moons through it. Not very successfully, but that was interested. I went to, planetariums a lot, read a lot of books, that sort of thing.
Did you ever think your avocation would end up being this?
No. I can't say that I did, but I think that that's a rather common response to that question. I mean, most people say, well, I never imagined doing this even 10 years ago. So there's that. By the way, George, I do need to say something here to avoid a slew of abusive emails tomorrow. I screwed up when I talked about Zeta Reticuli being very young.
I knew you didn't mean a million years old.
Well, the Pleiades, you see, are quite young. You know, they might be less than a million years.
And the Pleiades, maybe a billion years.
Where some aliens have come from. But Zeta Reticuli, that system is maybe 2 billion years old. So that's old enough. And I'm sure now that we observed it when we were doing our observations down with a telescope in Australia. You can only see it from the southern hemisphere. So
there's a tribe called the Dogon tribe. You've heard of them.
Yes, I have.
And they knew about the binary star system in the Sirius star system. Yep. Way before even telescopes spotted this. They claim that they were told from someone above about the star system. That would be another area I think you aim the array at.
Well, I have to say, Sirius is a very bright star, so it really isn't going to last very long. But the Dogon story about the fact that it has a companion, actually it has two companions, but it has a companion that's a white dwarf, they wouldn't have known that. That's true. That wasn't discovered until, I think, the Victorian era when people had bigger telescopes. But it's also the case that this story originated after the discovery of that white dwarf. And apparently there's some evidence, I don't know whether it's credible or not, that they were told about it having a second star.
What do you think of Roswell, that case?
Well, I think it's the best thing that ever happened to Roswell.
Yeah, that's true.
That's for sure. No, I sort of hesitate to make my opinion known here because, of course, Stanton Friedman was a great proponent of the
idea. Oh, my God, yeah.
That Roswell represented a failed landing attempt by aliens trying to get a good Tex-Mex meal in New Mexico. I don't know. I look at that story and I consider the fact that Project Mogul was running at the same time, for which there are still, I think, living witnesses to what Project Mogul was all about. It was a secret Air Force project to try and find out if the Soviets had the bomb at the end of the 1940s. And it accounts for all the aspects of the Roswell story. So here you have it. I mean, it could be a secret project to find out if the Soviets had the bomb, or it could be aliens that crash landed in the desert 40 miles northwest of Roswell. I tend to believe the first explanation.
And when are there anybody within SETI that believes we've been visited from ETs?
Well, I certainly haven't pinged them all on it, but I would wager next week's wages, which isn't much to wager, that none of them do, no.
None. Okay, and let me ask you this horrible question, and that is, if you don't get funding for SETI, what happens?
Well, I mean, essentially, it goes away. I mean, it's that simple. If nobody's willing to...
Is that a real possibility?
Of course it's a possibility.
Oh,
yes.
Gosh.
Yes. No, it's hard to believe, but it's true. And I might point out that you look at Europe, for example, or for that matter, Japan, China, all these places, they talk a good game. They say they're all interested in doing SETI because they all admit that a discovery would be very, very interesting and perhaps even important. But they're not willing to pony up the money. I lived in Europe for 13 years, and You know, they had the big antennas, they had the money, they had the talent, they had the expertise, they could do it. But they didn't. And the reason they gave for that was, well, you know, it's we're too serious for that. So that's unfortunate. But on the other hand, I think it speaks to the fact that in America, you can take a long shot. And, you know, Americans are willing to bet on the dark horse. And that's not so true in these other countries.
I don't know. It's I would hate to see SETI go away.
Well, I do, too. I mean, I don't know that it'll ever go away because it's always going to be somebody somewhere who finds it interesting. Because keep in mind that SETI is not a static endeavor. It's not that what we're doing today is the same that we would have done 10 years ago. It's always getting better because the equipment keeps getting better.
Can somebody get to Jeff Bezos?
Well,
a little check?
Yeah, well, I don't know the guy personally. You?
I mean, no, I don't know him.
I'm a good customer of his. Somebody like this, Jeff Bezos, and he does have an interest in this sort of thing. I mean, you need to find somebody who is interested, right? And, you know, I mentioned the chief technologist down at Qualcomm. He is interested in this matter, so he's willing to fund the development of new receivers. Well, okay, that's what it takes. Somebody, just having money is not good enough, and you can ask anybody who's looking for money for something. They also have to have a personal interest in the subject.
Let's take some calls here for you this hour, Seth. Let's go to Mark in Baltimore, Maryland, to get things started. Hey, Mark, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, George, for taking my phone call.
Thank you.
By the way, you know, I'd be willing to donate if the doctor wants to give out any information on how to donate. I mean, I'm not rich or anything, but, you know, I'm willing to donate because you mentioned donations before. And also, here's my question.
Okay.
I actually have two. One's a simple yes or no question. My first question is to the doctor, do you know how small of an object NORAD is capable of detecting? Because I was an old radar man in the Navy. So that's my first question. And my second one is just a yes or no. And that is, does SETI operate under any kind of secrecy oath?
Yeah. Well, the answer to the second one is the easy one, Mark. And no, we don't. There's. I mean, look, it's a nonprofit research organization. There's no policy of secrecy. Nobody has ever been told, hey, if you find a signal, don't tell anybody. In fact, we've had some false alarms, and, you know, they demonstrate that what really happens if you find a signal that looks promising, the media start calling you up right away and you talk to them. Repeat the first question. I'm sorry to waste your time by doing that.
But. Oh, no, you're not wasting my time at all, doctor. I was an old radar man in the Navy.
Yep.
We learned about NORAD and everything like that. I think that's something that stands for North American, something about that. But how they, do you know how small or large of an object that NORAD is capable of detecting?
Well, of course, you know, the real idea was to detect incoming missiles and something, you know, stuff like that. But if you consider the radars being used today, for example, to map space junk, which it's important to do because otherwise, you know, if the International Space Station collides with something the size of a tennis ball, then, you know, that's the end of the International Space Station. So they do want to map this stuff, and that's typically a couple of hundred miles up. And normally they can find anything down to the size of, depends on the day of the week or, you know, the wind direction, whatever. But they can find things between the size of a ping pong ball and maybe a baseball.
That's dramatic. That's pretty incredible,
yeah.
Isn't it? It really is. What do you think the next big breakthrough is going to come? Remember the old wow signal?
Yeah, sure.
In these little bursts that are coming in now, these fast radio bursts, is that equivalent to the wow, or was the wow big thing?
The radio bursts don't have the characteristics of a signal made by a transmitter. They really don't. And so I don't think that they're equivalent. And the fact that they're being found all over the sky, I think they're more equivalent to the discovery of pulsars back in the 1960s, you know, that were called little green men,
yeah,
by the Cambridge astronomers for a while, until they found three of them. And when they found three of them at different spots on the sky, they said, well, whatever this is, it's nature. It's not intelligence, so they stopped calling them little green men and eventually called them pulsars. And I think the same thing will happen with the fast radio bursts, as I said earlier. I think that within a couple of years, there are enough data now that I think within a couple of years, some clever theoreticians are going to figure out what the most likely explanation is.
We have Glenn in Harlings in Texas. Welcome to the program. Hey, Glenn, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, George, Seth?
Yes.
Great.
Say, Seth, appreciate everything you do. But I'm reminded of a cartoon I saw of flying saucer flying over the VLA, and the guy's pointing down and laughing and saying radio. I really appreciate y'all. And you mentioned that there were a lot of stars close in, and they all have planets too. I find that fascinating. Out to what, about a dozen light years, we've got about 30 or so stars, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple, several of them were found to have Goldilocks planets, and maybe even a couple. One of them had a couple of in the Goldilocks zone. I find that incredible. And I guess SETI's pretty much just searched all the close-in planets. Could you comment on that? But one thing before you do, Seth. I think the idea that they can't get here or we can't go there, you know, if you're traveling at relativistic speeds, ship's time, it's nothing. You don't have to go faster than light. The distances are easily traversed. My goodness. What is it, George? Is it 40 light years in 3 months?
I think so, yeah.
Well, if you can go 40 light years in 3 months, you got a pretty fast vehicle there.
Shoom.
Yeah, well, you're pushing it to the point where you're not, spanned out in your constitutional atoms. You know, you don't become particles of light.
No.
What won't kill you, in other words, just below the kill threshold, I guess, at speed. But could you comment on the close-in planets and the search? Have you all really scrutinized the close-in planets, close-in star systems?
Well, you know, we have and we haven't, because on the one hand, we've looked at essentially all the nearby star systems. And when I say nearby, you know, maybe 50 light years out, and quite a few of them out to 100 or 150 light years out. And what you say, within, you know, 15 light years or so, there might be 30 star systems. I mean, even the nearest other star system, Proxima Centauri, is known to have a planet that looks like it, you know, could conceivably be a habitable planet, right? And, you know, one should continue to look at that. But when we say that we've looked at them, you see, that's the problem. You look at them for a few minutes at any given spot on the radio dial, at any given frequency. And then you move up the dial and you look at another couple of million channels, and if you don't find anything in a couple of minutes, you move up the dial again and so forth. And so that means that if the the planet is inhabited, and but the aliens are on summer break, or they just took time out for lunch, you might not find them. So it's what you really want to do is to look at all the sky all the time over all the range of, you know, probable frequencies. That's what you would like. But, you know, in this world, this imperfect world, that's still not a possibility. So you can't ever rule out even star systems that you've already looked at. But we have looked at most of them. And, yes, indeed, I mean, there are probably hundreds and hundreds of planets, of which maybe one in five are habitable planets, even within 15 or 20 light years.
Seth, if the ETs are trying to communicate, would it be radio transmissions?
Well, you know, following up on Glenn's cartoon there, you know, maybe the aliens think that radio is kind of old hat, but you know that's not true, George.
No.
Definitely not. And, you know, as far as we know, we don't know the physics that we don't know. By definition, we don't know that stuff. And maybe there are ways to communicate that are much more efficient, right, or maybe conceivably faster than light communication. It doesn't seem to be a way to do that. Violates relativity, but, you know, what the heck. Maybe 1,000 years from now we'll look back and think that we were very provincial. That's possible. That doesn't give you any strategy for how to look, of course. So you go with the physics and the technology you have. I mean, you know, it's like telling Chris Columbus, and I've said this before, it's telling Chris Columbus, you know, Chris, these stupid wooden boats, You know, just hang loose for a while, and we'll put a motor on these things, give you a steel hull, and you can get across the Atlantic much quicker. But you know, the wooden boats were good enough. You go with what you've got.
Let's go to Annie in Alabama. Go for it, Annie.
Thank you, George, for taking my call. Hello, Seth. I have a comment and a question. My comment is that some people that might give some money for SETI would be the Vatican, Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump, the Obamas, and Chinese billionaires like Liu Yichian, the guy that bought the chicken cup for $25 or $30 million. And my question, he paid $30 million for a cup to drink tea out of.
You must like tea.
And I want to know, the question is, has SETI checked the signals to see if there are any patterns in between the length of time between the signals?
Yeah, well, Annie, the thing is, first off, you have to find the signal before you can answer your question.
Right.
Right? So since we haven't found any signal that is checked out to be truly extraterrestrial due to a transmitter somewhere, we can't really answer your question. But I think it's fair to assume that if you pick up a signal, that there's going to be some information on the signal. I mean, otherwise, you know, you got to sort of figure that the aliens are going to send an empty signal into space. You know, it's just like, I don't know, a porch light. It's on, but there's no information coming from it. So I suppose that there would be some information, but you would need a different kind of instrument to find that message. Of course, if we were to find a signal, I think that, there would be the interest and the money to build a much, much larger instrument and go back and look again and see if you can find a message.
Seth's website, of course, is the SETI organization, SETI, SETI.org, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Also, his name, Seth Shostak, Shostak, SethShostak.com. He's also an accomplished writer, including one of his books, Confessions of an Alien Hunter. That was a great, great book, by the way.
Oh, well, thank you, George.
That was fun.
Send me your copy and I'll autograph it.
Hey, that would be nice. That would be nice. Any speaking engagements coming up for you?
Well, there are always speaking engagements, indeed. I've been giving a talk in 2 days, 3 days, and then I'm going down to Las Vegas and talking there, and then I go to, well, never mind. You don't want to hear my travel schedule.
Well, some of them I may run into you.
You might. You might. I'm not coming to the L.A. area anytime soon that I know about, but...
Will you be at the Contact in the Desert in the summer?
No, I don't go to that. But I did see you, I guess, at what, Alien Con?
We were at one of the first Alien Cons.
Yeah, and exactly. Then they had one recently in Los Angeles that I was at.
All right, stay with us. We're going to come back and take final phone calls in just a moment with Seth Shostak from SETI. And again, website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And some other books he's got, Cosmic Company, Sharing the Universe, Life in the Universe as well. And we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Email me at george@coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with our special guest, Seth Shostak, our final segment here. Seth, the co-orbitals. Let me talk about a little interesting scenario here. Picture this. 100 million years ago, an advanced civilization detects strange signatures of life on a blue-green planet not so far away from their home in the Milky Way. So they try to send signals, but whatever's marching around on that unknown world at the time is not responding. So the curious galactic explorers try something different. They send a robotic probe to a small, quiet space rock orbiting near the life-rich planet just to keep an eye on things. What do you think about that possibility, that there are objects out there spying on us?
Yeah, well, it could be. It sounds like an idea from one of the Benfords, actually, because it has been suggested that there could be probes nearby. The thing is, you can't rule it out, but we haven't been able to rule it in because it's very hard to find these things. It depends on how big they are. You know, if it was the size of, an asteroid, it would be pretty easy to find.
Sure.
But if it's the size of, your living room sofa or something like that, it's pretty much impossible to find it, certainly with the kind of technology we have today, unless, they're not keeping radio silence or something.
I mean, it sounds like something we would do, right?
We might. Yeah, you might. Although, the problem, this gets into alien sociology in a way, but, are the aliens going to send a probe to our solar system because they found,
oxygen in the atmosphere of Earth 100 million years ago, and they weren't getting any radio signals from the Tyrannosaurus.
That's right. Who didn't have anything then, anyway?
Well, we had a lot of dinosaurs. I mean, you know, there was that. But, they didn't build radio transmitters, at least not frequently. So, you know, would they send a probe that is designed to last for 100 million years just in case the dinosaurs get wiped out and something more interesting replaces them? I mean, I don't know what the aliens might do, but it does sound like a bit of a long shot for them.
Let's go back to the phones now. Elijah in Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to the program, Elijah.
Hey, how you doing, George?
Great.
Good. I'm very excited that you answered my call. I listen to your show all the time with my band on tour. That's the first thing if we have a long night drive.
What's the name of the band, by the way?
Paint Fumes.
Paint Fumes, okay.
Paint Fumes, yeah. Like huffing paint, yeah.
Cool.
So my question is, I was thinking this the other day, do you think it's possible that we haven't had as many, like, abduction cases or sightings as we did back in, like, say, in the 70s because we have cell phones now, like, readily available video cameras and everything like that?
Well, Elijah, that point has been made by many people who are skeptical that we're being visited. They say, I mean, and it is true, first off, it's true that in the last 5 or 8 years, the number of UFO sightings reported to, I think, MUFON, I think that's where the data come from, has decreased a bit. Not a whole lot, but maybe 20 or 30%. It's going down. Up until that point, it had been going up. So, you know, maybe the aliens are losing interest in us. I don't know. But could it be due to the cell phones? I think maybe it could be, but, you know, the cell phones don't work any better than your eyes in terms of seeing things. But what has happened is that if you look at the photos that were made in the 50s and 60s of these UFOs, right, they were, you know, a little bit ambiguous, but today they wouldn't be so ambiguous because there'd be plenty of people with cell phones making videos and photos. So now the aliens, if they're here, have moved farther away from the cameras so that, you know, they always look about the same size to the cameras. It's kind of convenient. But I think there's truth in what you say, and I think there's something substantive in what you say, in that with so many people having cameras on them all the time, you would think that if the aliens were really buzzing the skies, there'd be a lot of really good photos.
What would you say will be the biggest breakthrough coming for what you're doing, Seth, if you could speculate?
Well, the thing we hope will happen is, picking up a signal that's unambiguously coming from the sky and not from a satellite around the Earth, but coming from deep space. And that has the characteristics of something made by a transmitter. I mean, that would prove that not only is there some sort of, you know, intelligence out there, but, they're at least as clever as we are. So that would be the most exciting thing. But what may happen first, although I'm not sure that it'll happen first, but what may happen first is that we find life on one of the moons of Saturn, for example, Enceladus.
Sure.
Good place to look for.
Or
that.
Europa.
Europa, although Enceladus is maybe a little bit better than Europa, actually.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people who study Mars are thinking maybe they'll study Enceladus instead because it's a little easier. And, you know, you would find essentially bacteria there if you found anything, and you might say that's not terribly interesting. But on the other hand, it would be very interesting because it would tell you that, all right, life is not some sort of miracle. It's just all over the place.
I think it is teeming everywhere. Let's go to Rich in Quincy, Illinois. Hi, Rich. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, George. Good morning, Doctor. Thank you very much for taking my phone call.
Sure thing.
A question for the Dr. Seth. It's an honor and a privilege, by the way. Every time I hear about SETI, I think about the Jodie Foster movie and First Contact, by the way. back in the 1990s, SETI and Berkeley offered the opportunity for people with PCs the opportunity to download and crunch data from SETI and return it back to Berkeley for further analysis. And then eventually it turned over to a software platform, I hope I can mention it, called Boink. And then I was one of those that was in the top 15% of data returns. And then I had a computer crash, and then all of a sudden, I kind of lost contact as far as how that data was returning, as far as, you know, any candidate signals. Have you had a chance to look at any of that data that came back from personal returns for signal candidates from SETI?
Well, Rich, you're speaking of SETI at Home.
That's right.
And indeed, it is a screensaver. It still is a screensaver. So you can reload it onto your computer. You know, maybe it's gone now, but you can put it back on because I think you can still find it. And I don't know what the total number of people that have downloaded that screensaver software is, but it's on the order of 7 or 8 million people. It's a lot of people. Now, they're not all running it all the time, but they are still using it at Berkeley to reduce some of the data they're taking for what's called Project Breakthrough. So it's still being used, and it has the advantage that you can really, you know, look at those data very carefully because you have so much compute power. So it's a good project, and it's still going, and you can still participate.
All right, good. Thanks, Rich. Appreciate it. Michael's in Virginia Beach, Virginia now. Hey, Michael.
Hi. Thank you so much, George. Seth, spell your last name for me, please.
Okay. S-H-O-S-T-A-K.
Okay. I don't mean to be hard on you. I've listened to you for many years on Coast to Coast, and you're obviously a very intelligent man. But I have to put you in the category of my fellow evangelicals. And this is more of an analogy to stimulate you. In fact, I would love to help you raise enough money to put a really advanced project on the moon in cooperation with Elon Musk. But here is what I think the evangelicals are missing in their approach to this thing, and I think you're missing it also. You are both too passive. You are listening for signals. They are waiting for Christ to return. This is their extraterrestrial contact. They're doing absolutely nothing to entice him to return. And I'm afraid that your listening is just not aggressive enough. It's not reaching out in a way that would be meaningful to a super intelligent civilization. So what I suggest as a fundraising project is that you put out a contest, put the word out that you're looking for the most creative approach to signaling outward that you can find that would be attractive to a super intelligent civilization. And I will raise an equal amount of money for that moon project for your current approach, a passive approach of listening. If that's a deal that you like, we can talk about it in the future right here on Coast to Coast.
Okay, Michael. Well, send me an email. But here's the deal. You know, there are people who agree with you, and there have been people within SETI, some of the early pioneers in SETI, who also agreed that maybe we should step up to the plate, as you kind of put it, and, you know, transmit something to entice the aliens to get in touch. And maybe that's a good scheme, but here's the disadvantage. I mean, there are people who are interested in doing that, not many, actually. The arguments against it are, one, some people think it might be dangerous. I'm not one of those people. I don't know that it's dangerous. I think that any society that could get here could, you know, pick up our radar. So they already know we're here. And so anybody that could come here and do any damage. But the real objection is something completely different, Michael, and that is the nearest star that might have an intelligent society on it could very easily be 100 or even 1,000 light years away. It's very unlikely to be less than 50 light years away. They're extremely unlikely because there just aren't that many star systems. So let's say it's 100 light years away. So you run this contest and you send this, hey, attention all aliens, we've got all these used cars, we want to sell you, whatever. Hmm. And it takes 100 years to get there. And if there's somebody there and they reply, then it's another 100 years. So now 200 years have gone by. And it's very hard to get funding for a project the last 200 years.
Yeah, it sure is. Seth, let's take some final calls. Ryan's with us in Tampa, Florida. Ryan, go ahead.
Yes. How are you doing, George?
Good. Thanks, Ryan.
I listen to your show all the time. I'm actually a first-time caller. For a very long time, ever since I was really young, I can't remember exactly how old. I was maybe around 8 or 9 years old the first time I ever saw what looked like a craft. And I told my mother about it because my mom's a single mom and we've always, you know, been together. And I pointed at it and I showed her and I told her it's right there and no one saw it. Well, I'd say maybe 5, 6 years later, my mother was in Cooperstown, New York, and she saw a craft and it came up out of what she described was a lake. And it changed a bunch of different colors, and then it went away as fast as she saw it. And situations like that has been happening to me for years now. The first time I saw one myself, personally, I was around 14 or 15 years old. It was 2, 3 in the morning, and I was walking home from a friend's house that only lived a block down the road. And I saw a huge, bright, blue-looking craft come into sight and then disappeared, leaving like a blue trail in the sky. And I mean, for years now, I've seen all these different crafts, and I don't know why it happens to me specifically, but normally they change colors, and I've heard that frequencies and sounds can cause, you know, different changing of colors and things like that. I just wanted to know, what was your take on that, and how long do you think before maybe one day there is some type of contact?
Well, Ryan, here's the thing. I often get phone calls with people describing stuff not identical to what you said, but something similar. And what I would recommend to you is, if this happens frequently enough, well, do you have a cell phone?
Yeah, I'm sure he does.
Okay. You know, just whip out your phone and make a video of it, right? Because if you just tell people that, then it's a story. And in science, stories are not terribly convincing. I have to say that. As far as when we will find any life in space, well, I bet everybody a cup of Starbucks that, you know, we should find ET in the next 24 years, and that's just based on some estimate of how quickly the experiment will improve. But maybe that's wrong. I did notice that the NASA chief scientist, 2 years after that bet, essentially told the press that she figured that we would find life in the solar system within 24 years. So that sounds like the number that people are willing to guess. But, of course, you can never be sure until you get the data. So, you know, I think if it's going to succeed, it'll succeed in our lifetimes. But, you know, I could be wrong.
Seth, the SETI website is available to folks, and you've got your own out there, right?
Yes, definitely. They can find me very easily. I might also encourage people who are interested in science to check out Big Picture Science. It's a podcast and a broadcast.
And you obviously take emails through your website, right?
We do.
All right, Seth, thanks again. Keep in touch with us, all right?
All righty.
Seth Shostak from SETI. His full information linked up at coasttocoastam.com, so do go take a look. Now, how many of you have really taken advantage of sunlight? In a moment, we're going to be talking about chasing the sun, how the science of sunlight shapes our bodies and our minds.